tonight.
Alright!
We're gonna have a TV party, alright!
Tonight!
Saturday Night Live!
Alright. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. A little later on, we are going to be talking about things that we're all doing wrong. We got some other food stories that we're going to get to. And we're going to talk about some of the biggest box office bombs of all time, which I don't think the Avengers will be. I just have a feeling. I have a strong, I don't know, I'm taking a risk on guessing that, but I don't think it's going to be a bomb. it opened in China with a one-day total of an equivalent of $100 million in one day. So it's going to be ridiculous. All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. Every couple of weeks, we talk with Dan Feinberg, our good friend, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Always lots of TV to talk about, and we're always happy to have Dan here. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much, Nick.
How are you, sir?
Oh, busy. How about you?
I'm all right. I'm pretty busy. And we've got a lot of TV to talk about, as usual. I don't watch Game of Thrones. I'm one of the six people on the planet who don't. But you did do. You have reviewed the premiere, and but I'm assuming you did. Of course, how many episodes have you seen?
I've only seen two. The two that have aired, HBO is keeping these very, very close to the best, especially with each week's increasing level of drama and chaos and mystery and whatever. So,
right.
Yes, they are not giving us things early. I had to fly to New York early in order to see the one that I saw early. So
right,
now
right.
I'm just watching them with everyone else.
And you watched it like at the big premiere party with everybody was there, and it was a blast.
Exactly, whereas the second episode I just watched on TV.
Okay. Kind of a letdown after that. Well, what are you thinking so far? I mean, I know, you know, everybody's watching it. It's the big thing on the television right now, so I thought we'd lead with it.
For sure. Well, first of all, why are you not watching it? Why is it not a Nick show?
I gave up on it three quarters of the way through the first season. I was like, I don't know what the hell's going on, and I don't care. So I just stopped. I found it utterly confusing, and I didn't care who was what or anything. There was, you know, there wasn't enough boobs for me to be interested. They tried, and there's the beheadings and dragons and all that stuff I should like. I just sat there every week going, what? So, and I just haven't gone back.
Fair enough. I mean, I can't argue if you gave it a few episodes, and it definitely is a show with a lot of moving pieces, and you have to invest at least a certain amount of interest. And some of the time, that's heavily paid off, and others of the time, perhaps a little bit less so. I think the first two episodes of the second season have been very much setting things in motion for the third episode that's coming this weekend. So
yeah, that's what everybody on my news feed was like when they finished watching episode two and they all posted, you know, all this stuff. Everybody was like, next week's going to be awesome. They really didn't say anything about the episode they just watched. They just said, next week's going to be awesome. So that seems to be the running trend there.
I think that without any question, probably the things that happened in the first two episodes with a little bit of careful editing and thought could have been combined into one, maybe 85-minute kind of prelude season opening episode, which isn't to say that I thought either of the first two episodes were bad. They were just very much both combined. There was the first episode was sort of putting everybody in place and reminding you of where they were and what the stakes were and all that. And then the second episode was basically all of the characters walking around saying that they were probably going to die next week. And that's... which is totally a valid reaction when an army of the living dead is walking onto your castle. It's not like anyone was, you know, discovering anything.
Right.
There's an army of zombies coming on the castle. This is not really spoiling anything, so hopefully your listeners are not freaking out. But yes, last week's episode was largely all of the characters going around saying, yeah, we're probably going to die tomorrow, and then the other half of the characters saying, hey, let's talk a little bit about the journey we've been on for the last six seasons, years, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I still thought it was very effective, because the fact is, when things start going crazy, when people start dying, when whoever it is who's going to take the Iron Throne eventually moves to the Iron Throne and all of that, there's endless room for disappointment and frustration. And as the show gets destination-generated, destination-driven, people are going to have it not live up to what their expectations are. And so there's a possibility for disappointment, whereas the past 2 weeks weren't like that. They were about bringing together characters who we hadn't seen together for years, who maybe when we last saw them, they were pushing each other out of the window so that they could sleep with their sister, hypothetically speaking. That might or might not be a situation.
Right.
And I thought all of that was handled extremely well. And this week, there were a bunch of scenes that were really emotional, that hit home in terms of simple, clean, beautiful performances by actors who have been living with these characters for years. Mm. And so there will be more carnage next week. There will be more action choreography. Apparently it's going to be 82 minutes of nonstop action. Everyone's talking about, oh, the biggest, longest action scene in the history of TV. And maybe it'll be great. I hope it'll be great. But there was something really satisfying about these first two episodes, and I appreciated it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I just wanted to mention this. We haven't talked since it premiered, because it premiered 10 days ago, 11 days ago. But I just want to mention that the day that it premiered, the Sunday that it premiered on the 14th, Chicago was slammed with 6 inches of snow, and I was like, HBO, bravo, way to go real far with your advertising to Vesto. Everybody in Chicago was posting. It was like, okay, nice. Okay, we got it, HBO. Winter is coming. And, you know, so we got 6 inches of snow in the middle of April, which is not uncommon here in Chicago every once in a while to get that. But I just thought it was really weirdly coincidental that happened. We got nailed on the day that Game of Thrones was coming back.
But then it was also 70 degrees the next day,
yeah.
and so that's when sort of the climate change allegory of the entire show really comes to the forefront, when it can go from winter's coming to, oh yeah, right here, summer. So Chicago, right. the whole show is really apparently all about Chicago.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's really what, maybe I should go back and start watching it again. I didn't realize that it was that local connection. But I'm assuming it's doing monster ratings.
Oh, heaven yes. No, the first week episode drew the largest kind of recordable audience in the show's history, and HBO has been putting together kind of fudging. I mean, they're not really fudging. They're just sort of fabricated numbers, because it's a combination of live viewership plus HBO Go, but only in 24 hours, on the assumption that really most of the people watching this final season really are watching it live, which is not the case with just about any other show on television. So people don't really want to have things spoiled. Now, the fact is, I really could spoil almost nothing for your listeners from the first two episodes. In terms of actual quote-unquote twists or revelations or whatever, that's not what the first two episodes have been about, but the theory, the expectation, the whatever, is that this Sunday's episode, people are going to die. And I think people are almost going to be disappointed. Fans are going to be disappointed if it turns out that only one or two semi-major or major characters get destroyed in this episode this weekend. So, it could be dozens of our favorite characters are going to be wiped off the face of the Westeros planet where this all takes place. And I don't know that I necessarily think that's the case, but I think this weekend's episode is going to be one that people are going to be making a point to watch live in a way that they don't watch anything this side of the Super Bowl and the Oscars live.
Yeah. All I know is judging by my news feed that everybody is going insane over this. There's no question about it. How many episodes are there total for the season?
There are only six, and the first two, it was a big deal that the first two were both under an hour. They were both fully regulation episodes.
Right.
My understanding is the last four are all going to be various degrees of supersized starting with this weekend's, which I believe 82 minutes is what everyone is saying. And, you know, at this point, the hype around it has probably reached a dangerous point. And if I were the HBO producers, I would be very quietly whispering, oh, yeah, it'll get bigger. Don't worry, just in case anyone's expecting this weekend's episode to basically be the climax of the entire series. So who knows? Okay. I'm looking forward to it, and I will definitely be watching live on Sunday night.
Okay, very, very, very cool. Yeah, so that's Game of Thrones, which needs all the help it can get. I know that it needs more publicity, just like that little indie movie that's coming out.
It is amazing the amount of oxygen that Game of Thrones and Avengers Endgame sucking up in the media.
It's incredible, really. I don't know if I've ever seen anything like it. You can't turn on the TV or anything or go online without seeing either of those franchises everywhere. And the people who star in them and the creators of them are all over the place.
It is it's not monomaniacal, because it's duomaniacal,
right.
I guess. But
right.
In terms of kind of, if you wanted to, like, if tomorrow Beyonce were to drop a new album or something, I think that would be the only thing that could kind of split it into three and that could actually equal the other two. But otherwise, you've got these two total juggernauts, and they're all that anyone is talking about.
Yep.
And I feel like there are other good things to talk about as well.
That's what we're going to do. We're going to break, and we're going to talk about other good things in the TV world. Okay, Dan?
Excellent.
All right, Dan, hang on. Dan Feinberg is with us. We're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll talk more TV with Dan, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And more TV to talk about right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200. That's also the number to call for Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. That's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. It's TV talk. Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. Lots of TV stuff to talk about, so let's welcome Dan back. You can follow him, by the way, on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And Dan, welcome back.
Thank you. So much TV. So, The Avengers, Endgame.
Yeah.
No?
No. Let's talk about the second season of Cobra Kai. Season 2 has premiered. So what do you think?
I love that transition. So either Avengers Endgame or Game of Thrones or Cobra Kai.
Right.
The thing about Cobra Kai is, and the second season premiered on Wednesday on YouTube, is that the first season was able to premiere with, at least for critics, with no expectations whatsoever. We got those episodes, and YouTube was like, yeah, here's our show. It's our 30 years after Karate Kid, Billy Zabka, Ralph Macchio. Yeah, we got them. And that's about it. And, I think we were all kind of blown away by the fact that the series itself turned out to actually be a thing of God forbid, a little bit of substance. I think that the first season is very much still driven by nostalgia, and it's driven by the idea that if Karate Kid was an important part of your youth or upbringing, or just cinema vocabulary from the 80s, you enjoyed revisiting these characters, seeing where they had gone, seeing the inversion of, you know, okay, what if Billy Zabka's Johnny Lawrence either wasn't a bad guy or was to some degree a victim as well, and he had a chance at, you know, doing it all over again, and could he become the good guy in this story? And the show worked because it almost couldn't possibly have been better. You can't imagine that story being told better than it was in the first season of Cobra Kai. Mm. And the second season, it's not told as well. And that's just what it is. It's repetitive. It doesn't step out of the mold that the first season stepped. So it's, again, it's all just building to Cobra Kai versus Miyagi-Do, whose karate methodology and themes will reign supreme, which is the better way of shaping young people into good people, and which is shaping young people into bullies. You know there's the big fight coming, and there's a certain amount of repetition, and there's a certain amount of diminishing returns from it, because if you're doing an underdog sports movie, you have to find a way to change the formula up enough in the second time around so that you still like the underdogs, so the underdogs haven't become the favorites.
Yeah.
And so the second season, to me, didn't really do that. But the thing is, if this season had been the first season of Cobra Kai, I'd be telling you, wow, it's a lot better than I would have expected it to be.
Yeah, I see.
And so that's where it is. I think if your expectations have gotten too high after the first season, maybe the second season will disappoint you. But if your expectations are somewhere near where they were in the first season, it works sometimes and often well. Just a little repetitive.
So by the way that you tell the story, it seemed like YouTube was like, yeah, here's a little show. And then the thing took off. Now, did YouTube handle the second season a little differently?
I think they had a sense that it was a bigger thing. The first season, we had screeners to us months in advance. YouTube was like, yeah, sure, review it kind of whenever you want to. We'd love to get some reviews for this. Honestly, any publicity is probably good publicity.
Right.
This time around, reviews were embargoed strictly to the start of when it premiered, which is the kind of thing that really doesn't make any sense to me, because reviews haven't actually been negative, because it's not bad, and a lot of the people who liked the first season loved the second season as well. But definitely, this was one where they knew they had a potentially big audience. They were boasting about the number of people watching the trailer and all of that. And yeah, it is, for YouTube at least, it's kind of become their only thing. YouTube has already, in fact, begun to step away to some degree from original productions. They canceled a number of their shows after only one season. They haven't really had any breakout hits beyond this. So for YouTube, this is kind of their only standard bearer. And I suspect it will continue to be. I really do think a lot of the people who loved the first season are going to like the second season at least as much, because it's roughly the same. It just comes down to whether your expectation is that it's going to do something bigger or better or smarter. And, you know, for example, it's not like Karate Kid 2 is a great movie. I think anyone who thinks Karate Kid 2 is a great movie kind of, their brain's a little bit out of sync.
Karate Kid
2 is still an audacious movie in the sense that they pick up the whole story and go to Okinawa, and it becomes this reverse culture clash thing. And it really does try to do something very, very different. Whether it does it well or not is almost secondary. This doesn't do that. It's set in the exact same part of the valley, filmed still in Atlanta, and it's basically summer vacation, so everyone has nothing to do other than train at karate the entire time, and so that's all they do.
Okay. All right. Well, it debuted on Wednesday, and it's on YouTube if people want to watch it. Okay. All right. I watched the first episode of Bless This Mess on ABC. I have the second episode on my DVR at home. I haven't watched it yet. Have you watched both?
I have watched both. They only had the first episode to send to critics before premiere, which is really never a good sign. And TV shows and TV networks shouldn't do that if they can avoid it. And since ABC had the second episode available literally the day after, I don't know why they were hiding it. But yes, I have seen both of the episodes of Bless This Mess.
Okay, tell everybody about Bless This Mess and the general concept of it.
The general concept is that it was created by Liz Merriweather of New Girl and Single Parents, currently of ABC, along with Lake Bell, who also directed the pilot. Lake Bell, anyone who has seen In a World knows that she's a very talented writer, director. And so the conceit is that Lake Bell and Dax Shepard play a rather stereotypical New York couple who they inherit his great aunt's farmhouse in Nebraska, and due to some circumstances and some missing things in their lives, decide that they're going to go to Nebraska and become farmers and leave their New York lives behind. And so faster than you can say, we bought a zoo or Green Acres or any of the other various shows and movies in which these things happen, they go to Nebraska and discover that they know very, very little about farming, and that they have a freeloading neighbor played by Ed Begley Jr. who lives in their farm, and that the town's store owner and sheriff is played by Pam Grier. And probably that's all the show has going for it, but that's theoretically at least enough, because those are some really, really good elements to have in place.
And also, Dan, don't forget Koechner's in it too.
Dave Koechner's in it. Lennon Parnham's in it. It's a really good cast.
A great cast. Great cast.
And so it's the kind of show where if you told me by episode 15 that it was going to become a really solid network comedy, I would probably believe you. So far, it's a little hung up on very, very, very familiar cliches and formula. And I do think I laughed a couple times more at the second episode than I laughed at the first, but that might just be the difference of 3 versus 2. But I chuckled at both episodes, and it's enough to keep me watching, because sometimes Liz Merriweather's shows start a little bit slow and get better. I thought that Single Parents started off a little bumpy and has become a show that I enjoy. It's not a show I laugh at a tremendous amount, but it's a show I like on a low level, and I can see how this would be that. What did you think of the first episode?
I actually thought it was funny. I laughed a lot, and I think most of it to do with the supporting cast. I thought Ed Begley was hilarious, and I thought the stuff between him and Pam Grier, I thought Pam Grier was really funny. I laughed quite a bit. The main problem is that I find the supporting characters much more interesting than the two main characters. And I happen to really, really like Bell a lot. And so that brought a lot of the reason why I enjoyed watching the pilot so much is because she's actually one of my favorite performers. I think she's a great writer and a very good director. So, and I like Dax Shepard. But again, yeah, I mean, you know, this is not, there's no, nothing new in this at all. You know what I mean? There's not one new thing in it, but I thought it was executed well. And I really thought the supporting cast was very funny. So I laughed quite a bit. There you go. Dan Feinberg is with us. And that we were just talking about Bless This Mess, which is on Tuesday nights on ABC at 8:30 Central Time. So there you go. All right, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more TV with Dan right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m., 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and for your Triple Play Thursday requests, one artist, three songs. Get your requests in now. We'll play them in a bit. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Coming up a little bit later on, we got a couple of food stories we're going to get to. We're going to talk about things that we've been doing wrong that we thought we were doing right, and some big box office bombs. All of that and more. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page, too, at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Right now, we are returning with our good friend Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Lots of TV to talk about. Let's bring Dan back. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. Let's do a couple of things that we talk about pretty much every time you come on. First of all, Better Things, that Easter episode was unbelievable. Unbelievable. Where did you stand on the Easter episode?
Well, did you prefer it to the toilet episode the week before? Because I think I might have premiered preferred the toilet episode the week before, but they were both great episodes.
We've talked about, it's the best show on TV right now. And Pamela Adlon is just, she's amazing. And the toilet episode was the hardest I laughed. I think at any episode this season, it was unbelievably hilarious. And, and, uh, and really, really funny and great and great. But the Easter episode kind of just punched me in the gut. The speech that Kevin Pollak gives about the kid's dad in the car, I just thought was unbelievable and beautiful and really beautifully delivered by Pollak. And that last scene with Margaret Avery was just, I mean, I was just, I kind of stunned when it ended. I was just kind of sitting on my couch going, oh my God. And that's the kind of level that, those are the kind of levels that Adlon reaches with this show. So on both levels, I think I'm in both episodes that have aired since we talked last, they're both unbelievably great in different ways.
I definitely agree that the episode, it just, it's something that she does so well, where she lures you along with light humor and silly humor and light humor and silly humor. And oh, there's Phyllis, Celia Imrie is her mother, and she's getting really competitive about Easter egg hunts.
Right.
She's knocking a little kid in the pool. And you know, oh, she's vaguely senile, and so this is sort of like, ha ha ha, she's funny. And then it just really does. It puts the knife in and twists, and the fact that the show can do that and does it so confidently and just kind of drops the mic and walks away.
Yes.
That scene and the way they use Kevin Pollak really is wonderful. And Kevin Pollak's having a very good moment. He's also being very well used right now on Billions. But that character can sort of have the flustery moments where he's just blowing up at his mother and it's like, oh, he's being a flippity-jibbit and whatever. And then he has that monologue with Duke in the back of the car, and again it's just, okay, I've been silly, I've been funny for 5-10 minutes, now I'm gonna actually punch you in the gut. The show does that so wonderfully.
And it's just so great. I mean, I look forward to it every week, and again we talked about it, that it's renewed, and that's just a really good thing. So that's one of the other things that we talk about all the time. Okay, so it took till the third episode of Barry for me not to laugh. And then what you were talking about before, I barely laughed, but it was an unbelievable episode this past Sunday night.
Was this past Sunday the third or the fourth episode?
Fourth episode.
Okay. Yeah, okay. No, this past week was about as good as I think Bill Hader's ever been.
Oh my God,
He was intense and scary this week, there was very little funny in this week's episode.
Yeah.
Other than perhaps Henry Winkler's reaction to hearing the real story.
Yeah.
Which, again, I'm never sure what the real story is or isn't, but this week's version of this story, if we assume it's real, Winkler has one beat when he reacts, which is hilarious. And then, of course, you had NoHo Hank, whatever he was doing this week, which for some reason was playing Dr. Moreau from Island of Dr. Moreau.
Right.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
But so those two beats made me laugh. Otherwise, the entire episode was me watching Bill Hader going, wow, he's a little bit scary. And now I also can't wait to see him in the second part of It. Later this year, like I want to see him being freaked out and scary and intense because he's really good at that.
He's really good at it, man. And it was a very intense episode, the way they ended episode three so abruptly was like, whoa. Like when that ended, I was like, uh-oh, you know, the shot of Hader's face reacting to the ex-boyfriend showing up was pretty amazing. And they took that last, like, it seems to me like they took the final image of that, the insane, you know, surprise and tenseness of that moment, and just stretched it out to half an hour.
I think I'm admiring more each week what they're doing on that show, and I think there was just a learning curve with viewers and how the show is adjusting its tone. And I admire what they're doing. And, you know, if I want broad laughter, Veep is still delivering week in and week out. And it's not suddenly becoming a darker, more serious show. It's just being Veep. So it can do that. And I like that the two shows can have the contrast. It's almost like over an hour, you get the kind of back and forth contrast that Better Things does in 22 minutes.
That's right. There you go. Exactly.
Whatever.
Exactly. I did unfortunately watch an episode of Abby's, And I thought I just watched it because you when you reviewed it the last time you were on, when you reviewed it, there are people in it that I really like, including Neil Flynn. And I'm not, I will not be watching, I will not be revisiting Abby's. I watched the one episode of it, and I thought it was just terrible.
It's not good, and I've now seen, I guess, five total episodes, and I think I might just check out, and if it gets renewed, check back next season to see how it's going,
because
very clearly whatever happens in the rest of the season isn't really going to stick or be deeply meaningful. So if it wants to get renewed, I can definitely give it another shot come hypothetical season two. But
the episode that I saw was the one where they're trying to get Neil Flynn to date the other person in the bar, you know, and all that, and I was just like, like 15 minutes in, I was like, oh my God. And then I just kept laughing because the thing that you mentioned that just made me laugh, the only time I laughed was when they mentioned the live studio audience outside in the bleachers. And that cracked me up when you talked about it a couple of weeks ago. And that was the only time I legitimately laughed, was when they referred to the audience. That's the only time I laughed.
And I still, again, having seen five episodes, I still don't know what they think they're getting out of it. It's just confusing. It's not like it's a bad idea, but they haven't really changed the look of the show in any way. It doesn't look or feel different for all the live outdoor shooting. It should feel more immediate in some way, and it really feels very canned and very old fashioned in a way that I don't think it's intended to.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's get up to our biweekly mention of Fosse Verdon. Love this show. I absolutely love it. I just think it's great. And the two leads are particularly Michelle Williams. Michelle Williams is unbelievable. But they're both really great, and I love the style of it. And I love how each episode has kind of a real different directorial style to it that actually pays attention to the way Bob Fosse would direct. You know, the last one with him wanting to have Gwen Verdon in the editing room with him trying to edit Cabaret, and then the backstory behind what happened to Gwen Verdon earlier in her life, I thought was just really great and beautifully done. And the week before was my favorite episode so far of the season, where she gets cast and it's their first scene, their first scene together when she's auditioning. I just thought that was just such beautifully directed and so well written and choreographed. That was my favorite. Second episode of the season was my favorite so far.
I thought the scene where he has the audition with her, the choreography audition, I thought that was a great scene. Otherwise, I thought the second episode was my least favorite of the three. I don't know. It just didn't work for me otherwise. Though, you know, I liked the recreation of the stuff from Damn Yankees, et cetera. The third episode, I liked the stuff with her so much. And yes, this episode, much more than the first two, I thought was really Michelle Williams just going, okay, clear out.
Yeah.
This is me.
Yeah.
This is me showing what I can do.
Yeah.
And I thought she had three or four beats that just killed me. And also, but the problem with that was that every time she does that, and it's not to say that I think that Sam Rockwell and his hairpiece are bad, but his story is one that I feel like I know, and her story is one I don't feel like I know.
Right.
So every time they concentrate on him and his self-destructive tendencies and him getting drunk and flirting with another floozy, I go, okay, I know your story. I've seen your story. Get back to her.
Yeah.
And or alternatively, give me the Patty Chayefsky reluctant babysitter show.
Okay,
I would watch.
Dan, hang on. Okay, we got to take a break.
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. He's referring to a scene that took place in the last episode where Patty Chayefsky is babysitting for Bob Fosse's daughter. It's classic. Okay. Anyway, we got to take a break. We'll come back. We got the news, and after the news, more TV talk with Dan Feinberg right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday, that is. So get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. 100. All right. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking, we've got some things that we've all been doing wrong, some food stories, and some stories about some of the biggest box office flops of all time. So stick around. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. So Dan Feinberg is here. We're talking TV. Let's welcome him back. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Nick.
Hey, what do you make of this story about the writers firing their agents? Over 7,000 WGA members fired their agents. What's the story behind that?
The story behind that is that agents are outraged about what they see as illegal and unethical, basically side-dealing or back-dealing involving agencies, the practice known as packaging, which is basically when agencies can put together writers, directors, and actors from in-house and make them part of a single package. But writers say that this is a practice that doesn't incentivize the agents to get the best deal for each individual one of their clients, but rather to get the best deal for their agency. And I mean, I tend to be pro writer and pro guild, and I have no particular reason to be pro agent. And so I am at this moment very much in the corner of the writers. I don't have a clue what this is actually going to mean, because they filed a suit, the Writers Guild did, against the agencies, and they're seeking a dissolving of the current terms of the contract between them, but also restitution from all of the years of packaging practices and the money that may or may not have been lost. But given that this is Hollywood and Hollywood accounting, no one is ever going to see that money, or if they do, it's going to be for years in the future. And so I don't know what ordinary people are going to notice coming out of this. And that's where I'm just raising my eyebrows and sort of standing back and watching to see how this story is going to evolve, because this is not like a Writers Guild strike situation where suddenly people are going to run out of scripts, and you know, Big Brother is going to come back in the middle of the year, and we're going to get censored episodes of Dexter, and there's going to be no new TV. It's not going to be that. It's just going to be a strange, imbalanced situation where writers are working under different terms with managers representing them. It's going to be a very interesting thing to watch play out, and I don't have a clue what it's going to mean or do.
I've never seen this. I mean, this has never happened before, where 7,000 writers fire their agents. I mean, this is a first, correct?
This particular variation on labor strife is unique. And of course, you know, listeners will maybe probably remember the 2007 Writers Guild strike, which actually produced a lot of tangible changes, but also speed bumps that viewers could actually notice at home. I've referenced a couple of them, including the random in-season Big Brother season and Dexter on Sunday nights on CBS with bleeps, because they simply ran out of programming,
right.
And a lot of shows really never recovered from it. You know, whether something like Pushing Daisies is kind of the quintessential example of a show that was doing spectacularly before the Writers Guild strike, and then when it came back, the audience had forgotten it existed, and the show died after two seasons. So, this is a very different thing from that, and it's completely possible that people at home who don't follow 50 entertainment journalists and three trade publications on Twitter won't have a clue that this is even happening.
Right, true.
But for people in my particular bubble, it really is a thing that everyone is talking about pretty much nonstop. So.
Yeah. Well, they're covering it, and we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting to see what happens. It's not like they've never had a writer's strike before, obviously. There have been writer strikes in the past several times, but this is just unique in that they're firing their agents.
This is a different thing, and it's not going to be a strike,
right.
At least as of now. So it's going to be something else, and the tangible impact on the things people watch on TV and the things people see in the movie theaters, it's possible that they're may not be one, but it's also fully possible that there could be a large impact, and we're just going to have to sit back and watch.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on what's going on there. I was very kind of disappointed to see that Netflix canceled Santa Clarita Diet.
So I don't know what's happening with Netflix. It's a mystery to me what is happening with Netflix and with what they're keeping and what they're not keeping. And I'm not sure what is driving a lot of their decisions, especially on shows that have been around for only a couple years and where we don't have a clue, of course, what any of their ratings are. So it's hard to understand. And Netflix executive said a couple weeks ago that they might be more transparent with ratings in the future. And I don't even know what that means. Like, they said that they were going to, I don't know what, I don't think that Santa Clarita Diet has been officially canceled, honestly.
Oh, okay.
But I think that, I don't think it's been official, but no one's saying anything.
Okay.
So that's what the problem is. To the best of my knowledge, it is not dead, but there have been stories, if you've looked around in the past couple of weeks, about Netflix and why Netflix has been canceling a lot of shows after two or three or four seasons.
Yeah.
So, like One Day at a Time a couple of weeks ago, that one is canceled, and no one knows what's coming with that. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of limbo, and Santa Clarita Diet is one of those shows that's in limbo. I, you know, tell people to listen. I think that at this point, not to listen, to watch. I think that at this point is what might give the show a fourth season, but I don't know necessarily what the advantage is for Netflix if it's not being watched.
Yeah.
But the third season certainly ended in a place where it made me curious what the fourth season was.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
I would be sad if I didn't see that. But yeah, no, if you look at the renewal patterns and cancellation patterns, it's a little bit too soon, because they tend to go sort of 4 to 6 to 8 weeks afterwards, either for renewal or cancellation. If people want this show to survive, you know, they need to watch, they need to tell a friend, and who knows. I'm not wildly optimistic, but I want to believe that I'll see where that third season cliffhanger left off.
Yeah,
but I'll see more.
I would like to see it. I think it's a really good show. For people who don't know, it's Drew Barrymore and Timothy Oliphant in the Suburbanites, and one of them just happens to be a flesh-eating zombie. And the kids are great on that show. The kids are so good on that show. And I really like it. I hope it doesn't get canceled. I'm a fan.
Yeah, you got to lead with the zombie part, because otherwise people think that it's going to be, Timothy Oliphant, Drew Barrymore, romantic comedy, whatever.
No.
It's a zombie show that's a zombie comedy that stars Timothy Oliphant and Drew Barrymore.
And so. When we say zombie, it doesn't back down from that stuff. It is gross, and if you're a zombie fan, there's a lot of lovely gore in it, and it's got a great sense of humor. So, all right, all the zombie fans need to unite and get that show and keep watching it. So,
agreed.
Speaking of Netflix, you reviewed A Huge in France. Tell everybody about this one.
Well, you see, Huge in France, which you probably haven't heard about because its star is in fact not huge in America, and that's the premise of the show. That's really all there is. The star of the show is Gad Elmaleh, mm-hmm. who is indeed huge in France. He is described as either the Ray Romano or Jerry Seinfeld of France, and he comes over to the United States where somehow, at some point, he had a relationship with a woman played by the wonderful Erin Hayes, who one day will get a part worthy of how wonderful she is. And he has a son who's an aspiring model, and his ex is dating a model turned actor played by Matthew Del Negro. And he basically, this playing himself, he goes around telling everyone that he's huge in France, and no one in America knows who he is, and that's the premise of the show.
Uh-huh.
This is not hugely inspired, though it has moments. The reason why this would be interesting but also disappointing is that it's created with Andrew Mogul and Jared Paul, who created The Grindr, the Rob Lowe, Fred Savage show from Fox, which was a pretty charming and likable Hollywood satire that only aired one season because sometimes Fox has trouble getting people to watch things.
Yeah.
That's how it goes. But yeah, it's not very funny. It doesn't give you really a reason to understand why the main character is, you know, huge in France and not so much in America, and doesn't really go much beyond that. The part that I find interesting is that the subplot involving the son wanting to become a model and involving the stepfather whose only dream is starring in a Fox period drama about a famous model himself. It's played with a kind of interesting intensity and seriousness, even though the major thrust of it is that the son wants to get pec implants and the father has to find a way to afford his pec implants. I thought that was kind of amusing and audacious, but Netflix only sent out 4 episodes of this to critics, which is always a limitedly inspired sign because Netflix sends out oodles of episodes of everything.
Yeah.
I didn't feel any need to watch beyond the first 4, but the results may vary. Maybe you are in fact French. If so, you will find the main character to be huge.
There you go. All right. What are you working on next, Dan?
Well, what do I have coming up? One of the reviews I have coming up the next couple of days is of a Chicago shot show, Red Line on CBS.
I have so many friends in that. It is ridiculous. I literally know about 8 people in the cast. So it's crazy.
It is. What I will say is that it is a better than average network drama that actually has things on its mind. I do not think that it is as good as it would be if it had gone through the development pipeline at basically HBO, FX, you know, the usual suspects.
Yeah.
Netflix again. But I am reticent to be too negative about it because networks take big swings, and this is really a medium swing, but they even take medium swings so rarely that I want to pat CBS on the head for trying.
Right, and right.
I don't care if it's condescending. I want to say, okay, good. You're trying to do a show that's about race, class, and the American city. Good for you.
Yeah.
Do more.
Yeah.
And then that's my reaction. It's not a great show, but it tries, and
yeah,
it does Chicago right sometimes. You sometimes get the feeling that they're on the ground in Chicago shooting and that has value. So that's the thing that I am working on in the next couple days that's of use and interest to your listeners.
Well, we will definitely get the reactions the next time you're on, because I will be watching it, and then you'll, I'm sure, have the review going, and so we'll talk about it the next time you're here. Dan, always a pleasure. Thanks for hanging out with us, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Until the next time, Nick.
All right, buddy. Take care. Dan Feinberg, everybody. He's the best. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. He'll join us in a couple of weeks to talk more TV. All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back after this on 720 WGN.